So for those of you who are on the call and or who are not familiar with Dr. Celestin, let me just give him a very quick introduction. Joe, in my opinion, is one of the best homeopathic educators in our community, and I would say that's true internationally and around the entire world. But on top of that, he's one of the most skilled homeopathic practitioners that I'm aware of. And I say this both from having sat in on his clinics and also from the many patients that I've referred to Joe who have done exceedingly well. And so when it was suggested to me a little while back to do another one of these webinar classes on the homeopathic treatment of mental and emotional disorders, I immediately thought of Joe as being somebody to team up with who has just a lot of personal experience in the treatment of these types of conditions and brings a tremendous amount of humility, knowledge, wisdom, experience, and overall acumen to everything that he does. So it was really my pleasure to invite Joe to join us and to do this class on the homeopathic treatment of mental and emotional disorders. For those of you who are not familiar with this webinar series, we did the first one about 7 or 8 months ago on snake remedies, and then I'm doing one currently with Dr. Will Taylor on new, old, and forgotten remedies, and then we're going to start one in September with Dr. Celestin. It will be a 10-week course, both over the phone and via the internet, and we'll be addressing a number of different types of mental emotional diseases, cases, follow-up, materia medica, and so on and so forth. So, Joe, perhaps you could just start by giving us some sense of what you were hoping to accomplish through the 10-week course.
Well, you know, what I was considering was the concept of some problem-centered learning. The way I like to teach my classes is through the use of most often what I like to term short, bite-sized cases, chalked with lots of teaching points. So, for example, you know, I find for myself the way I prefer to learn, the way I find materia medica really comes alive for me. Certainly, we need to study the provings. We need to study the way that the masters have interpreted materia medica through the lens of their own experience. But when we do a case, we actually get to model the thinking of the practitioner. We get to learn, well, which rubrics did he choose? How exactly did he come to solve this? So the puzzle becomes, which rubrics did he choose? How did he create a genius to the case? How did he relate it to the materia medica? And how did he finally come up with some degree of certainty that this was the remedy he wanted to give? So then we have to go into the materia medica and try to follow his train of successful thought. Each little modeled case that we do sort of bends and shapes our mind. That was an old song, wasn't it? Yeah.
Back in the 60s, but nobody remembers.
Bends and shapes our mind so that we too follow in the footsteps of these phenomenal prescribers. Prescribers really that have not been equaled since. So when we do this, when we study the cases out of the old IHA and the rest of the Hahnemannian journals, this is what we're doing to ourselves. We're modeling our thinking processes so as to follow in the footsteps of these geniuses. Okay. Now, the other point then becomes, when we get a case of something, it behooves us to take a quick look at what is this medically? I mean, what's the definition? What can we learn a bit about what goes on with this medically? And so we can learn about the natural history of the illness and what to expect from it. Also, what to expect in the way of a homeopathic cure. So all these points put you in the driver's seat so that when you're actually confronted with a real case, it's not so far off. It's not so strange. You can see the signposts as you go along the highway there, and you know what to do, and you better know how to actually manage your cases as they come up. Does that make sense, Kim?
Yeah, and Joe, I'd like to reiterate, the thing that I really appreciate about your teaching approach is that you make everything obvious and transparent. And by the end of the case, everybody knows how you came up with the remedy prescription, and they're actually able to completely emulate your thinking in themselves. And that's something I think is really critical, and just something that I think I'd really like to emphasize about the way that you approach it.
Well, you know, Kim, it's the very beginning of the Organon, right?
It's true, yeah.
Part of the definition of what homeopathy must be, according to Hahnemann, is according to clear and comprehensible principles.
Yeah.
So, you know, you may not be able to do it as well as I, only because I've been doing it longer, but you should be able to begin doing it and understand what your outcomes need to be. And if you don't, I haven't taught it well enough. You know, if all I've created is a series of students who need to study with me because, I once spoke to a class who had been with a particular well-known teacher for quite a while, and I said to them, have you actually seen any cures using this methodology? And they said, well, no. And I said, but you've been with this teacher for, 2-3 years already. How do you account for this? They said, well, we feel that if we stay with him for another 3-5 years, we'll get it. It's not acceptable, Ken.
Yeah, I hear that for sure, yeah. So, Joe, you know, since we're going to be focusing on the homeopathic treatment of mental and emotional disorders specifically, is there anything in particular that you could say about the treatment of mental and emotional conditions versus any other type of a condition that we treat in homeopathy?
Well, you know, as Hahnemann states, one of the great difficulties in treating mental and emotional diseases is that they're often what he called one-sided, or what later on Pierre Schmidt referred to as defective diseases, in the sense that they do not portray a fully clear and obvious totality. So one of the advantages here is the learning of how to investigate these. You know, one of my great loves in homeopathy is actually learning how to take a case. To me, this is the great, great art of homeopathy, learning how to render the patient's experience into language capable of being translated into our technology. You know, this requires skill, it requires a lot of questioning technique, and I love questions. I spent a lot of years studying disciplines like NLP, just so that I could enable a facility for questioning so as to render symptoms usable. It's one of my great things. The other thing is we need to study hygiene, because so much of mental illness is rendered incurable by not paying attention to the patient's hygiene. A lot of these people have a lot of susceptibilities to the environment, food sensitivities. We need to be able to study the map of a patient's sensitivities in order to protect them from overreaction to these during the course of cure. So really it becomes a microcosm for a lot of tools that we really desperately need to just practice everyday homeopathy anyway. But it's more intensely so because often the cases are not obvious.
You know, Joe, one of the catalysts for this class was a discussion on Minutus about the success of homeopathy in the treatment of manic depressive disorders. And there was quite a bit of discussion on the Minutus website over whether homeopathy could be effective in the treatment of these types of conditions or not. And I know that we had a subsequent conversation, and you had agreed actually to present a case or two of patients who have been diagnosed with that condition. Could you comment a little bit about that just the general discussion and your success using homeopathy in manic depressive disorders?
Sure. Let's start with some of the difficulties. First of all, you know, just for the safety of the patient and also the comfort of the practitioners, especially those of you who might be a bit newer to homeopathy, one thing you definitely need when treating these people suffering from bipolar disorders of any kind, is make sure that you do overtly, explicitly enlist the help of the family. You know, if people have a difficult episode and wind up being hospitalized, then of course, treatment is markedly derailed, and you don't want people saying, I told you so. So we need to ensure that there's an ecologically sound environment to begin the treatment of these people. These people, you know, we need to know that the families, the partners are all on board, and that they're going to be willing to work with you even through some of the rough spots, even if hospitalization is necessary. The second salient point, most of these people are going to be on medication prior to coming to see you. However, the medication, you know, I like to use the term horizon. The medication only sort of lowers the horizon of obvious illness. It really doesn't eradicate it. So that although they're better, there still will be a marked ability to see, say, half the screen still full of illness. Don't worry about the medication. Once somebody is fully accustomed to their medication, once you know they're over that period of side effect, you can still see a horizon of illness, take an appropriate case. Remedies can still work quite well. The difficulty that you'll have is at those points where, you know, if you're not working in conjunction with a psychiatrist, unfortunately, I have some cases where I am working with a very sympathetic psychiatrist here in Toronto. When you don't have that, when you are working independently, perhaps even without the knowledge of that psychiatrist in the situation, if he decides to switch drugs on you, there will be a period of confusion in your own treatment, and the patients need to know that too. Was that clear, Kim?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So, you know, Hahnemann's very interesting. Kim, do you recall what Hahnemann said a mental disease was?
What was a mental? It was the same thing as any other type of disease.
Yeah, Hahnemann actually said that, you know, at the beginning of the section in the Organon, where was it? Kim, around 210, 211?
Yeah.
That the where he begins to describe things, he actually tells us, and this is fascinating. It's something I've never fully been able to confirm. Perhaps you can help me with that, but he says that actually the mental disease, a true mental disease, is actually a one-sided manifestation of a prior physical illness. I find that fascinating. So a true mental disease is actually originally a physical disease, often a severe physical disease, that is sort of sunk into the sunset, at least in terms of its physical side. Say a severe lung disease, a severe heart disease, a cancer, an infectious disease that was quite severe. And its intensity sinks into the sunset. It's no longer physical, but all of its aggression suddenly becomes manifested at the mental level. To me, this is absolutely fascinating. So here's a guy, Hahnemann. In his time period, they were still beating the hell out of people who were insane, right? And here's a guy who is saying true mental disease has a physical basis, a biochemical, perhaps, basis, a pathological basis. It's unbelievable. It's an unbelievable insight for the time. And every time I think about that, I go, wow. Wow. We know today, for example, in schizophrenia, that there is an altered biochemistry, right? That we can see it in the urine of schizophrenics. And here's a man who, well in advance of any of this, had this insight that he had gleaned simply by pure observation. But what I find even more fascinating is, in practice, I've seen schizophrenics. I've seen people with psychotic illness. I've seen people with bipolar disorders. I've never been able to confirm it. Have you? I mean, I don't think Andre has either. That, you know, that there is a severe physical disease, often just prior to the onset of a severe mental disease, that goes south and the intensity kind of reemerges in a one-sided mental sort of manifestation. Find that fascinating.
Are you familiar with that? There's that really great case, Joe. It's a Henry Clay Allen case of a fellow who's insane, and they give a whole number of different remedies, like, you know, stramonium, belladonna, hyoscyamus, without any results. And then he goes back into the history of the patient, and he looks for the remedy that the person needed during a previous flu, which had been tuberculinum, and he prescribes it, and it's, you know, to make the point that you have to go back into the history of the actual somatic suffering of the patient in these one-sided situations to actually be able to find the remedy in the first place.
Exactly, which goes to the point, it's all a question of skills in case-taking, establishing a very clear timeline, and understanding the case. Also remember some of the wisdom of Edward Whitmont. He was a wonderful man. He was a Jungian analyst, right? He was a medical doctor, a chiropractor, a naturopath, a homeopath. He studied with Elizabeth Wright Hubbard. He's a wonderful guy. And he would often say, in severe mental disease, you often need a remedy based on physical symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So the concomitants become very, very important. Mm-hmm.
And Joe, specifically in terms of manic depressive disorders, well, can you tell us about your results and success?
Manic depressive disorders, we've had good results. You know, we've been able to decrease patients' medication, in some instances able to get them totally off their medication. But a caution, it's not a one-shot deal. It's the treatment of a severe and, in homeopathic terms, a very deep chronic mental illness. So it will take place over the course of years. It is a battle in the trenches over a number of years, 3, 4, 5, 10 years.
So your experience is that it's something that can be treatable through homeopathy, but your own experience is that usually it's a more protracted type of treatment that's involved.
Yes. And again, most of the cases I've gotten have been cases that have already been hospitalized, have come out, or are on some medication in order to avoid hospitalization, but we've been able to greatly reduce the need or eliminate the need for medication, and they're living far more productive lives.
That's great. That's great. Now, I almost hate to ask this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Are there any remedies in particular that have been useful in the treatment of these types of disorders?
In my own experience, you know, I've had the occasional very seldom used remedies, and I hope to present some of those cases.
Oh, great.
But most often, you know, it's a question of the good old tried and true remedies. Often, one of the top 24 polycrests. I hate to be boring, but...
No, I mean, I think it's a lot of people's experience that, you know, certainly makes a lot of sense that things like calcarea and phosphorus and Nat-Mur are going to be common remedies in practice, and I don't think we should apologize for it, you know, if that's what our practice reflects. I don't think that's really much of an issue, but perhaps you could tell us about some of the specific things that were associated with treating this type of patient, though.
Often I find that diet and regimen is of extreme importance, and we need often to begin with that. A lot of the times these people have horrible diets, horrible lifestyles, and again, unless you have a family backing you up, the treatment is often quite difficult. You have somebody living by themselves to their own devices, it's a strike against you from the beginning if they really refuse to control any of their lifestyles. Mm. You know, manic episodes can be set off in some people by as much as, you know, sugar binges.
Right.
Or very sad episodes where they encounter some sort of social obstacle, a rejection. They'll often be sensitive enough to set them off. Mm. So one of the things we do try to do is to get them involved in some sort of group that is positive. We try to get them involved in monitoring their own lifestyle and appreciating exercise and good diet and involving the family in that. So that sets the stage. It becomes quite important. I had a crazy case once. You know, in the old days, I don't know if you recall this, but in the old days as a naturopath, we used to do a kind of test. I don't know if you ever heard of it, Kim. called the pulse test. Did you ever hear of that for food sensitivities?
Yeah, where you would introduce a new food and just see if their pulse would change by more than plus or less 20% or something?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I had a patient suffering a severe depression, and she also had a history of chronic migraine, and the two would come hand in hand. There was a concomitance between the migraine and the depression, and I really couldn't get a handle. This is just an example. I really could not get a handle on it for quite some time. The usual suspects, the remedies didn't seem to work very well, and it did seem as if there was like this erratic occurrence to it, no specific etiology. So I decided to investigate as to whether or not it could be hygiene and lifestyle, and I had been using this pulse test, you know, with some moderate degree of success, and we found over the course of pulse test. Now, with a pulse test, you take a baseline of getting a person to take their pulse after they've been up. They're up and active, but not physically active, just up and awake and alert. They take their pulse. Before each meal, they take their pulse. After each meal, they take their pulse. And again, about 10 minutes after the conclusion of the meal, if their pulse rate rises by 10 beats per minute or more, they were sensitive to something in that meal. And when we can sort of cross-examine a number of meals, we can triangulate on some suspects. And what we do with those suspects is something called elimination and challenge, where we take the food out of the diet for a few days and then reintroduce it with a vengeance to see if it can precipitate a group of symptoms, almost like a proving. And we did that with this one lady, and believe it or not, the only sensitivity she ever had was to a specific kind of processed cheese slice, which she ate about twice a week, and which we found later, about 3 to 4 days after ingestion, would cause a severe migraine followed by a depressive episode. And once we eliminated that treatment, taking the case was so clear. She became a very clear polycrest. She had very clear thermal modalities, all of which were quite evident. So just, you know, a cute example of one of the things that can be important.
Joe, what about patients who are suicidally depressed? Now, you know, I know that in my practice many years ago, I actually had a patient who did kill themselves. I'm just curious, do you have a lot of these types of patients? What's your success rate? And do you have any special considerations that you take into effect with these types of these patients?
Very, very good question. So first of all, in practice, especially the last few years, it's become more and more common that people will seriously entertain the concept. And so when you get that, when you get somebody like that, it becomes the chief symptom in the case, of course, because it's a very important and very profound mental symptom. Generally speaking, I know it sounds a little like rote prescribing, but I take a careful case, and generally speaking, my first remedy to eliminate, now that doesn't mean I prescribe it by rote, but the first remedy to eliminate after a careful case-taking is Orem. You know, I have used Orem with success in that condition at least 15 times now. And very often people will come back. So I'll give them a remedy, whatever the indicated remedy might be. As I said, by far and away, most often, Orem, when these people are quite serious. And I'll have them call me the next day. I'll usually have them back within days. I'll have them on the phone every few days. I will extract a promise from them that they will not harm themselves, at least until we speak next. And I keep doing that every time. Will you promise me? And they've been good with that. Now, on one occasion, I have to admit, somebody virtually hung up on me and said they were going to commit suicide. I didn't get through the consult. I called the police. I called the police, and I got quite a thank you from them later on because they were restrained. But now I've lost my train of thought.
were talking about the patient who basically hung up on you, and
yeah, they were very serious about it.
Yeah,
I was gonna just briefly mention some of the important issues around case taking in that context. So, you know, there are some wonderful rubrics in that. When you do get somebody who has a decided suicidal impulse, and again, the first thing is to ensure their safety and perhaps the need for reportability. But once you do that, investigate it. You know, some of the more challenging questions, you need to take the case on, of course, the etiology of the state. But then again, you want the state elucidated, and there's some quite remarkable rubrics, you know, in the synthesis under the suicidal disposition. And one of the great questions is, do you envision yourself doing it in any particular way? And that will often lead to a very precise remedy if, in fact, they do have a very consistent visualization of having, you know, of doing themselves away in a particular manner.
So, Joe, you're saying that, like, if he says he's going to hang himself or shoot himself or throw himself from a window, that you've oftentimes found that to be very useful in differentiating the best remedy choice.
Yeah, it really does help, but only if that visualization is fairly spontaneous but has been repeatable over some time. Like, you know, whenever they think of doing this and it's a strong desire, the same kind of visualization appears, then yes, those specific rubrics quickly narrow your search for the correct remedy. And, you know, a few other well-chosen questions can really differentiate remedies rather quickly.
And Joe, what kind of success have you had with suicidal patients?
Except in the situation, I've had two suicidal patients. This one that hung up on me, that has subsequently come back. Another that just discharged themselves from my care after the very first visit, really. And again, I alerted their family. But other than that, you know, people have responded really well.
Hmm.
They've come back. They've, you know, perhaps at subsequent visits, very soon after the first days or certainly within a week and after a few contacts, people very, very often, most often say, look, I'm still very depressed, but no, I don't think about that anymore.
And Joe, what about, you know, there's one category of patients that's quite challenging for a lot of people, and that's patients with anorexia. And what about that category of patients? What's your experience with that?
With those people, there's a very high rate. Again, what I look at prognostically for success in the long run is the degree of understanding of homeopathy on the part of the family who is supporting the severe anorexic.
Mm.
The more they're uncertain about homeopathy, the quicker they'll leave.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, their response to homeopathy is fabulous.
Basically, what you're saying is that you, if you don't have enough time to work with them, which oftentimes happens, you're not able to get any results with them, basically.
I've lost some people in the initial stage where there's been perhaps a mild physical aggravation of some sort. And people didn't understand it, or they were a bit skittish about the prospect, and quickly just, you know, switch practitioners.
Right.
Where the family understood homeopathy, comfortable with the concept of walking the patient through an initial aggravation. And again, I don't prescribe to purposely evoke an initial aggravation, but it does occasionally happen.
Right, right.
Even with low potencies, even with LMs, that to me is a rate limiting step. But generally speaking, the response of an anorexic is excellent, often very quick, at least in terms of an accommodation of their body image. The nutritional aspect has to come around.
And when you mean nutritional aspect, you're just saying just a certain consciousness about...
You can help their mental attitude. You can help their appetite, but they need to maintain a kind of consistent hygienic improvement in their caloric intake.
Right, right.
And it's the relapse, and you need to maintain close contact. You know, this stuff about seeing a patient once every 2 to 3 months, that won't fly.
Right, right.
You need much closer management.
Right.
Now, Joe, a lot of times when we're working with patients, you know, who are emotionally or mentally disturbed, there's sometimes dynamics that exist within the family. And I'm just curious, to what degree do you feel that you need to have the family be involved in the treatment of these types of patients? I mean, in terms of them receiving counseling or homeopathic treatment themselves?
Often I will recommend homeopathic treatment themselves. Counseling is a variable success, I find.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very individual art, very much dependent on the counselor themselves. You can't trust uniform results.
Right.
Well, when I'm having, it's a great point, Kim, when I'm having difficulty with a patient, whether it's a child or somebody that needs support in any enlarged way, and I'm having any kind of difficulty, I believe, finding a very clear remedy, I will want to take the case of the individual closest in personality or body type to the patient involved. And often I'll take both parents if I'm uncertain, and I'll want to see which remedies may operate successfully for those people in terms of stimulating their overall health. That'll give me a huge clue as to what will be a benefit for their child or whoever it is they're supporting.
Interesting.
And, of course, the side effect is exactly the primary intent of your question, that it does increase harmony in the family.
Right, right.
I can't tell you how often I've treated somebody, a severe depressive, a manic depressive, and I'll never forget this one case, this lady who complained of her husband being an awful human being and said, you know, after I took that remedy, it's amazing how he changed attitude.
I love it. So, Joe, I'd like to let some other people ask some questions as well, but, you know, some of the things that we're going to be talking about during the course is manic depression, OCD, depression, anxiety, phobias, neurosis. Do you want to say anything about your approach to these various conditions, anything you'd like to share about the class or what you're hoping to achieve with it?
What I'm hoping to achieve is by using cases from the literature, by using cases I've had, I want to help people exercise their ability to assess a case, create a genius to the case, research the case, use the repertory, and come to independently, with a degree of independent thought, come to their own conclusions, so as to someday come to their own mastery. What I want to do is I want to show some of the successful strategies used. Every case is unique, whether it's an ingrown toenail or manic depression. We need to know what is common to the symptoms of the disease. We need to have some insight and circumspection around what might be characterizing and peculiar of the case. Basic homeopathic procedure.
Fantastic. So for those of you who have not yet taken any of these courses, either with myself or with Dr. Taylor, let me just share with you that the classes will be starting on September 9th, 16th, 23rd, 30th, October 7th, 14th, and then November 4th, 11th, 18th, and 25th. Each class will be 2 hours long. There will be high-quality PowerPoint presentations for each of the remedies discussed, as well as cases and repertorizations of all the cases. So it's a multimedia-rich course, lots of excellent materials. And if you haven't had a chance to study with Dr. Kellerstein, you're in for a real treat, because not only is he a very gifted educator, but he's the real deal. He's somebody who knows how to practice homeopathy like a master and how to impart his knowledge so that other people can duplicate his success in their own practices. And so I'm very excited about the class, and I'd like to open it up and see if anybody else has any questions that they'd like to ask Dr. Kellerstein or myself. Hold on 1 second. Any questions he has?
I'd like to know what Materia Medica would be the best to have on hand, or what books?
In general for the course?
Yeah.
Joe, did you want to give some suggestions on books?
Sure. There are two kinds of books that we need to have at our disposal as homeopaths, as a professional homeopath. So the first type of book is not the kind of book that you're going to, you know, hunker down and read with a glass of wine at night. Something like Allen's Encyclopedia or Herring's Guiding Symptoms, I think are both of absolute necessity. I mean, of course, along with Hahnemann's Chronic Diseases and Materia Medica Pura, those three are the Hahnemann, Allen, and Herring are the basis of our profession. You need to have them, but you're not gonna read them except for specific detail relating to a case. Things I like to read, I like to make sure are bite-sized and chewy, meaning small things that give a large amount of information in a very easily digestible fashion. One of my favorites is Nash, anything written by Nash. Nash's Therapeutics, I love. I love Harvey Farrington's Homeopathy and Homeopathic Prescribing. I like Margaret Tyler's Drug Pictures. So if you have those,
so what you know we can do is we can post a little reading list of various titles that we would recommend. I don't think you're going to need any specific books because all of the materials, all the Materia Medica that we present, will be prepared as high quality handouts, and all the cases and all the repertorizations. But we will put up a little reading list of suggested Materia Medicas and repertories and philosophy books as well.
Yeah, there is no one reference for all of mental illness. You know, there are some very good ones, but most of it, because we're researching not just mental symptoms or mental syndromes, but because we've got to look up the totality of symptoms, we need complete Materia Medicas.
Right. All right. Other questions for Dr. Celestine or myself?
I have a question about Dr. Celestine had said, that Hahnemann said that all true psychological disorders begin with a physical disorder. And my experience is the reverse. And then Dr. Tellerstein said, but that's not really what he's observed. Did I get it wrong, or is that what you said?
That's what I said.
Okay. So my inclination is to discount that thought.
Well, the one does not discount the other. What you're referring to in the sense of psychosomatic disease, Hahnemann also refers to early in the Organon, where he said that psychological states can lead to disease and even to death. But those he considered diseases beginning with the psyche, and often treatable by methodologies that are verbal and that affect the psyche. And the other is a true mental disease. I think something today that we would probably consider to be not so much a mild or even a severe anxiety disorder, but something more like a severe schizophrenia or a severe psychotic state. Hahnemann believed first started with a spontaneous suppression or a one-sidedness occurring on a physical plane. So, no, you know, he's not saying one thing or the other. He actually, Hahnemann specifically in the Organon, talks about psychosomatic disease far before the medical profession ever even thought about it. I mean, the medical profession didn't validate the existence of psychosomatic disease until somewhere in the 1970s. Hahnemann talked about it in the Organon. So no, he also talks about disease originating from the mental plane and working its way down. But he said he's talking about a different class of disorders. He's talking about things like severe schizophrenia, which he believed began as a suppression or sort of a subsidence of an aggressive physical illness whose physical symptomatology vanishes, but whose aggressive energy gets funneled into a mental state. That's what he says in the Organon. But he does not discount. In fact, he says there are psychosomatic disease as well.
Great.
What is your experience?
Well, my experience is that even with people with severe psychological states, even though I try to find a severe physical illness just prior to the onset of the mental illness, I personally have not been able to validate that. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's just my experience. But, you know, I have to say both ends of things. However, certainly with a lot of mental disease, you see how it might begin very early on in a person's life, even though they've had a relatively good upbringing. So although I see a lot of psychosomatic disease, disease beginning in the emotional or mental realm, I also see where somebody may have genetically picked up a kind of mental disorder, or it seems as if they were just hardwired in some way biochemically to arrive at that point. I don't think I can make an overall and sweeping statement. I think I've seen cases of both kinds. Does that make sense?
My perspective is that all physical disease starts at the emotional and spiritual level. But I have seen schizophrenia and other things like that. But my experience is, so far, it's all started with drugs, with drug addiction, and then that short-circuited them in some way. So I have yet to see a schizophrenic who didn't have a history of doing drugs. But maybe that's just unique to Southern California.
Well, I've seen here in Ontario, I've certainly seen schizophrenics where the onset of their... Some visibility of the onset of their mental disorder started prior to any drug use and actually begins often in early adolescence. There's some phases of instability, some evidence of emotional episodes, breaks, and then they vanish, and then later on they come back with a bit more of a vengeance. So I cannot, I have seen it where breaks did occur as a result of drug use, but I've also seen it where there was no history of it at all. So I hesitate to make any sweeping generalizations. You know, we've got to leave the field open. Once, you know, what I'm very prone myself to, once I think I have a conclusion, I tend to hold that idea a bit too close to my heart, and I want it to be true for everything. So I try to shy away from that sort of stuff because I'm vulnerable to prejudicially thinking about it. So I prefer to hold the field open and just say, I'm not really sure.
Anyway, it's a very interesting discussion. Let me open up for other questions.
Yes, you said in the beginning that you have to ask, what is this medically? And I'm wondering whether you can really trust the labels that are thrown out today about autism or Alzheimer's, whether you can really trust all these,
Joe, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. And it's a great question. So the question is, can we trust labels? And you know what? We can only trust labels. I only trust labels in a general way. I use labels in the sense to know what the prognosis is. So if something is of a mild depressive nature and we expect some kind of resolution with or without treatment in 6 months, okay. If something is a more severe schizophrenic thing and it has no tendency towards resolution, what we expect is a chronic disease of a high ongoing caliber. So it's only something that sort of alerts me to a possible historical tendency in that person. I don't use it as the gospel for any other thing. Also, I just might use it to say, well, you know, this kind of symptom is fairly frequent in schizophrenics, so because they have these paranoid delusions, I'm not going to take each paranoid delusion as being very unique and peculiar. Does that help the query?
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Good.
I'm wondering, Dr. Kellerstein, what percentage of your patients that you work with are on antipsychotics? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hear the question, Joe?
Of the severe schizophrenics that I'm working with, a great many of them are on antipsychotic medication.
And Joe, do you, anything you want to share about how you deal with that?
Again, just as I said in the beginning, once they've developed a kind of a tolerance to it so that they're over the initial effects of the up and down and the inside out and the side effects that always occur the first 3-4 weeks, and once they're coasting fairly smoothly, you will see a horizon of illness, and they will help you differentiate what's a drug effect from what's their disease effect. You can still get a real good case. You can still help them out. And often with the psychiatrist's, blessing, and certainly the patient's blessing, you can begin to reduce the antipsychotic medication if they're well under control. Now, in some instances, the antipsychotic medication really won't get rid of the delusions or the hallucinations, the voices, the whatever, but the remedy will. And, you know, I've met some psychiatrists who are very grateful for it, and they're fine with it. Others, of course, don't want to hear about it, but that is a management issue. But it's okay. Homeopathy will still work for you.
But Joe, in general, in Ontario, the medical doctors are happy to work with you to wean their patients off of their medication? Or
no, it's very rare. There are one or two psychiatrists I've had the good fortune of running into who are okay with reducing medication or at least talking with me about the possibility.
Yeah. Okay.
A question?
Yes, please, go ahead.
I have a question like with OCD or an anxiety where the prefrontal cortex is somehow influenced, that it's damaged a certain extent because they have trouble with executive skills and all of the things that are in the prefrontal cortex when they have these problems. Does that get cured, or does that stay the same, or how do you address anything like that?
I don't really address the neuroanatomy of the problem. I really don't know how. Remember, in homeopathy, the only thing we get to address is the dynamic disturbance. How do we know what the dynamic disturbance is? It's only evidenced by the totality of symptoms. How do we prescribe? Almost solely on the characteristic symptoms of the case. What do we observe? We observe that people can improve over time. We observe that their obsessions and compulsions over time grow less and less, that their levels of freedom and expression and spontaneity will improve. But do I know what the neuroanatomy of it is or how it is? No. I mean, I can hypothesize that we know that the brain is capable of incredible neuroplasticity, much more than we ever thought before. So even in the face of some damage, it may be able to wire its way around. But really, what I care about most is, can they get better? And I don't really want to use a medical concept to limit my ability to say it might get better. I want to see what happens. As long as you can see the whites of their eyes, you can fire. As long as you can see some kind of characteristic aspect to the case, some kind of genius, some kind of totality of some degree of unique symptoms, and you can move that totality a bit, then there's hope you can move it a lot. Yes, you're right. If there's clearly a lot of neurological damage, the more neurological damage is evident and is final and fibrosed, you're not going to change that tissue. But again, there is neuroplasticity, there is adaptability. You never give up, you just keep going.
Great.
May I ask another question?
Sure, please. Who's asking?
This is Dorothea.
Hey, Dorothea, go ahead.
You said that when you find someone who's suicidal, you ask them exactly how they are intending to commit suicide, and if it's spontaneous and not, and also long lasting, you know, it's gone on for a while, that will guide you toward the remedy. Could you give us some examples of that? Like,
we can just open one of the rubrics.
No, your experience, the case.
Oh, there was a shooting. There was a person by shooting, and Aurum was wonderful. There was a person who had the vision of having himself injured by driving his car purposefully into a brick wall. forum was wonderful. There was a person who constantly had the vision of cutting himself up with a knife. And arsenicum was very, very useful. So those, I may have had one or two more cases, but those are the ones that immediately come to mind.
Great. Other questions about homeopathic treatment of mental emotional disorders or the class? Or
I just have one question about the price.
Yeah, sure.
It was, I think...
Yeah, it's regularly $400. There's an early bird pricing through July 31st of $225. And also the first 50 people who sign up get a free book. And it's choices either Perceiving Rubrics of the Mind, Medic of the Mind, or Cross-References of the Mind.
That was that was U.S. money, correct, not Canadian?
That's U.S. dollars, that's correct.
Okay, so if we're here in Ontario, can we pay by Canadian money?
Well, if you pay by credit card, it'll just get exchanged automatically.
I wouldn't be paying by credit card. Okay, I just wanted to, I guess I have to figure out the difference in price between...
Yeah, we can figure, we can work that out for you if you need to figure something out. We can figure out what the exchange rate is if you need to contact us about that.
Okay, and... how late can we pay? Like a price, but if we don't have the money till September, is that still accepted?
You can pay after July 31st, but the price will go up after that.
It goes up to 400?
I believe it does, yeah.
Okay, but we can still pay even up into September if we don't have the money right now?
That is
now?
Correct, yes. You just wouldn't pay the discounted price.
Right. Okay, yep. Thank you.
That's correct. But, you know, call us and we'll try to help you out somehow to get the discounted price. If you put something down or something, maybe we can hold it for you. Or...
Oh, I like that. Okay, I'll definitely call you.
Okay.
Call you, Kim?
Yeah, or call just you. Call the number on the webpage and you can... just call the number on the webpage and... or I'll give you my number.
Okay.
It's 707-822-822. 5807.
5807.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll call you, Kim.
Okay, great. Any other questions about the class or?
Yeah, I have a basic question. Dr. Kelsey, what do you mean by the genius of the case?
Did you hear that, Joe? She's asking about.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got some static.
Yeah, she's asking about the genius of the case. If you could explain what that is.
Sure. So the genius. A lot of authors have put it in different ways, but, you know, when Hahnemann taught us to take the totality of symptoms of the case. So the totality of symptoms is basically all of the changes occurring in this organism since the earliest perceived departure from health, since they first got sick. So that's what we're first interested in getting in case taking. All the symptoms which are undoubtedly diseased that have occurred since the person first became ill. Then out of these, there are going to be some symptoms that are very well defined. So some of the symptoms are vague and really don't help us in identifying a single and unique remedy. For example, headache or malaise or fever. But some symptoms are a little bit more well-defined than that. Some of them have what we call modalities, things that make them better or make them worse. So a headache that's worse at 10 a.m. in the morning. Wow, that's suddenly very sharply defined. Or a headache that instantly occurs if you're exposed to the brightness of the sun. So suddenly something vague becomes something very clear and defined. Now, the more something is very clearly defined, the fewer the number of remedies will ever have been recorded as helping to cure it. And as homeopaths, we have a very selfish outcome. We want to arrive at a homeopathic diagnosis, and a homeopathic diagnosis equals a remedy. So that when we are looking for the symptoms of something, we are looking for symptoms that are so well described, or so unique, or so peculiar, that only a small group, or perhaps even just one symptom or one remedy has ever been recorded as curing that symptom. When we have, in our case, a good number, say 3 or 4 or 5 or whatever, of these very characteristic symptoms, we have a small nucleus of symptoms called a genius, or the most characteristic symptoms in the case. The genius of the case are the small group of most characterizing symptoms, most useful symptoms in pointing to one and only one remedy. And the genius is what must closely correspond to the genius of the corresponding remedy.
Great. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Well, we probably have time for just one more question.
Kim?
Yes?
Sorry. My question is, what time of day will the course be held?
The class happens on East Coast at 8 p.m. and West Coast at 5 p.m. And I believe that it's on Wednesday night again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So, we try to do the best that we can to accommodate everybody's needs, but between the West and the East Coast, that's about the best.
I have a quick question about the course itself.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Would it be beneficial, even though I'm so new to homeopathy, to sit in on this course?
You're just starting your studies, homeopathic studies?
Yes, but I'm doing it all right now because there's no.
You know, I personally think the answer is yes, but it's something you would probably have to evaluate with, the institution that you're studying with and see if it's appropriate, because there'll be a lot of basic introductory concepts that'll be introduced, as well as some more advanced concepts, but I think that even if you're fairly new, you should be able to benefit from it.
Okay, that's what I'm thinking too. Thank you.
Yep. Okay, well, any other questions before we say goodbye?
I have one more.
Sure, go ahead.
Dr. Kellerstein, being that you're a chiropractor, wanted to know if you ever came down to two remedies, if you ever decided your choice of remedy based on maybe muscle testing?
Well, in the early years, I actually used to do that, but I found that my accuracy really wasn't improved. It was still hit and miss.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know what? At some point a long time ago, I decided what was it I wanted out of practice quite selfishly for myself. And what turns me on the most is homeopathy. I wanted to work at being able to distinguish and differentiate remedies based on what I see and not having to flip out to some esoteric stuff in order to do it. Now, I don't put that down. There may be people out there who are great at it, and I admire that. But I wanted to be a homeopath who could make distinguishing diagnoses on the basis of what I see and what I can elicit. That's just what turns me on the most.
And you do a good job of it too, Joe, let me tell you. Okay, so that's just about all the time we have. Yes, I wanted to just welcome all of you to, if you have the time and inclination, to please join us for this upcoming course on the homeopathic treatment of mental emotional disorders. I can promise you it'll be one of the best things you've ever done in homeopathy. We have a store full of incredible materials, cases, repertorizations, Materia Medica, and I can assure you that you'll walk away with a much greater understanding and knowledge of that aspect of homeopathic practice. So, Joe, I want to thank you very much for taking the time out of your schedule.
Oh, thank you,
everybody,
Kim,
for joining us.
You were great.
And, look forward to talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks
a lot.